Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look at what appears to be a state of war between Russia and Georgia. We'll be speaking with Colonel Dmitry Trenin, who is the Deputy Director of the Carnegie Moscow Center. He's chair of its Foreign Policy and Security Policy Program. He, of course, served in the as a colonel in the Soviet and the Russian armed forces from 1972 to 1993, including experience working as a liaison officer with the external relations branch of the group of Soviet forces Germany and as a staff member of the delegation to the U.S.-Soviet strategic nuclear arms control talks in Geneva from 1985 to 1991. His latest book is Getting Russia Right, and it appears that the Bush administration and the extent to which John McCain represents a continuum have not got it right. So I'll be looking into the notion that had Georgia become a member of NATO as it wants to be, what would the reaction be to the current Soviet encirclement of, or the Russian encirclement of Georgia? It would certainly make NATO appear to be a paper tiger. We'll speak also about the economy, major issue in this presidential campaign. The economy continues to apparently not reach its bottom, particularly in housing. So we'll be looking into that with Dr. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he's also a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center, and we'll be talking to him. He is one of the founders of Mother Jones, formerly managing editor of Ramparts, and currently serves on the editorial board of The Nation, a political advisor to presidential candidates George McGovern, to Senator Kennedy, Ron Dellums, and Edward Markey, among others. And we'll be talking to him in the second part of this hour. And then we'll talk about China's opening to the world with its spectacular Olympics display, the theme of which is Welcome Friends. We'll look into how much this is for domestic consumption in terms of China's revive nationalism, and clearly Chinese citizens are proud of the way they've opened up to the world, but they're of course continuing questions about China's human rights record and its support for abusive regimes around the world continues. Let's now go to Moscow and speak with Dr. Dmitry Trenin, who's a senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment and deputy director of the Carnegie Moscow Center. He's chair of its Foreign and Security Policy Program. And from 1993 to 1997, Dr. Trenin held posts as a senior research fellow at the NATO Defense College in Rome, a visiting professor at the Free University in Brussels, and a senior research fellow at the Institute of Europe in Moscow. He served as a colonel in the Soviet and Russian armed forces from 1972 to 1993, including experience working as a liaison officer with the external relations branch of the group of Soviet forces Germany and as a staff member of the delegation to the U.S.-Soviet strategic nuclear arms control talks in Geneva from 1985 to 1991. His latest book is Getting Russia Right. And before we get into the obvious that nobody's been getting Russia right, particularly here in Washington lately, it seems to me, Colonel Trenin, that had the Georgian leader got his wish, which is to join NATO, and if Georgia were now a member of NATO, the fact that NATO can't do anything much about what's happening militarily to Georgia at the moment would essentially leave NATO hanging out to dry as a paper tiger, would it not?
Well, I would say that if Georgia were a member of NATO today, Georgia would not have attacked South Ossetia. Georgia would not have launched an attack against a town resulting in 2,000 people dead. I don't think that NATO would have allowed that. But NATO, again, demands that the countries that join the alliance solve their territorial and other major disputes in its own territory and with its neighbors. And Georgia has not done that. So that was, I think, a major hurdle on the road of Georgia's accession to NATO.
So what led the Georgian leader then to bite off more than he can chew? I mean, surely he must have some concept of the relative power of his neighbor Russia and the relative powerlessness of this small land country with a population of 5 million?
Well, you can only guess, or I can only guess at this point. We haven't heard from President Saakashvili about the motives, but I can only speculate. And my speculation is something like this. Saakashvili was resolved to restore the territorial unity of Georgia, and he saw that as his mission. And for a long time, he was basically ever since he became president of Georgia, he pursued a policy of integrating Georgia and expanding the control of Tbilisi over the regions that under his predecessor were outside of Tbilisi's control. He was successful in Adjari, a small province on the Black Sea. And he tried to move into South Ossetia and resolve it militarily back in 2004. And basically, at that point, the relationship between Georgia and Russia, which started to become pretty warm, including between Saakashvili and Putin, dramatically deteriorated because he clearly wanted to solve that problem by imposing his control over an unruly region, if you like, a Chechnya-style operation. That failed. But ever since, Saakashvili has been trying to improve the capability of the Georgian armed forces precisely with the objective of using them to restore the territorial integrity by force. And now, and I apologize for a very long answer to your question, but I'm coming to the end here. I think he believed that he had only a couple of months, basically, to do that. He has a good personal relationship with President Bush, and President Bush has a warm place in his heart for Georgia. But after November this year, America will have elected a new president. And if that president's name were not John McCain, who also sympathizes strongly with Saakashvili, then there would be a question mark. And also, very, very lastly, Georgia was a candidate to receive what is known as Membership Action Plan at the Bucharest summit of the NATO alliance. And at that point, it failed to get it over the objections of European countries, especially Germany and France, that pointed to the unresolved conflicts. So the next meeting of the NATO Council that would look into the matter is this December in Brussels. So he had precious little time, Saakashvili, to resolve the conflict, and he decided to move in, hoping that he would be able to annihilate the South Ossetian separatists, which he almost did. And when the Russians moved in, and he clearly understood that the Russians would move in, he would be able to portray that as an invasion of Georgia by the mighty Russia, and then call for Western, especially U.S. support, which I think what has happened.
Well, it's not forthcoming, though. I mean, how could it be this naive to think that the United States, with its hands full in Iraq and Afghanistan, under any circumstances, could suddenly come to his rescue? That's mind-boggling. But prior to this situation now, and I don't know, and I guess maybe you're there in Moscow, you might have a better sense of whether it could spin out of control. But prior to this, starting in late 2005, Russia imposed an embargo on Georgia's agricultural products, and then it basically dried up its export market. And then Georgia expelled Russian diplomats, accusing them of espionage. And then President Putin cut off all land, sea, and air and rail links to Georgia, as well as postal service. And then he cut off natural gas supplies in the winter. And President Putin apparently has basically used the situation in Kosovo, which he strenuously argued against. He's turned the West's logic on its head, if you will, and used that against the West, has he not, in terms of what's happening now in Georgia?
I think I would agree with the Kosovo analogy. This is precisely the way that it's looked at from Moscow. So you basically have a regime in Tbilisi, which could be compared in the Russian mind today with the regime that existed in Belgrade until 2000. And Mr. Saakashvili is now cast into the mold of the late President Milosevic. And clearly, South Ossetia takes and Abkhazia take the niche that was occupied by Kosovo in the Balkans. Now, the Russians are saying that what they are doing is protecting a small people, 80,000 strong in South Ossetia, from a policy of ethnic cleansing and even genocide. The word has been spoken at the Kremlin. And what they have done was to do was something that the West, led by the United States, did back in 1999 in the Balkans. And they're using some of the language that the United States used at that time. And they even to the extent that the Russians are saying that the United Nations Security Council was unable to take a clear stand over the Georgian incursion into the zone of conflict, and it did not reach any conclusion at the two meetings, first of which was convened at the request of the Russian ambassador. So you have many analogies, and in the Russian mind, and I would say that this view is very much widespread across the board in Russia, what one is dealing with in Georgia today is very similar to what the West thought it was dealing with in Serbia back in 1999.
And, of course, it's worth noting, Colonel Trennan, that John McCain's chief foreign policy advisor, Rani Schoenemann, is a former lobbyist for Georgia, and the United States Army and Marines have been training the Georgian military, which appears to be very much on the defensive at the moment. Now, the president of Georgia, he's suggesting that Russia really wants to take over Georgia to the extent to which it is exporting oil through a pipeline through Georgia to the Black Sea, and there's another pipeline supposedly in the works for natural gas, and that Russia's real motive here is that it wants to control the export means of export of all energy out of the former Soviet Union. So how much is that an agenda here?
Well, I think that this is part of the reality on the ground in the Caucasus. But I would say that the central motive for Russia's, not for this action that was undertaken by the Russians in the last few days, but the policy of Russia vis-a-vis Georgia, and you gave a number of examples of Russia sanctioning Georgia in different ways. Basically, that was done with one objective in mind, to keep Georgia away from NATO, because the Russians see NATO as a threat, a major threat to their national interest and even their security. Let me explain. The Russians, because the Russians have very good relations with such NATO countries as Germany and France and Italy and Greece and a number of others. So the problem is not really NATO. The problem is that the Russians view the regimes that have been that have emerged as a result of, especially as a result of color revolutions, but even more broadly as a result of the collapse of the Soviet system. The regimes in Eastern Europe, and especially in parts of the former Soviet Union, as anything but independent, and they see them as essentially satellites of the United States. So from the Russian perspective, the Russian government's perspective, NATO membership would turn those countries that have not a say in how they in how they do their foreign policy, but it would turn them into platforms for whatever action the United States wishes to undertake, using them as platforms. So basically, they see the former republics of the Soviet Union that have taken a pro-U.S., pro-Western course as American satellites. And they're asking the question, why does the United States need satellites, platforms, so close to the Russian borders? What is the intention of the United States as far as long-term intention, long-term strategy, as far as Russia is concerned?
Well, we know that Russia is extremely concerned about U.S. intentions to put radars and anti-missile systems for an Iranian threat that does not exist in the former Warsaw Pact countries. And obviously, having a presence in Georgia would be even closer, if you will, to Moscow. But what's the end game here in terms of, at least as much as you can predict, Colonel Trennan, the military end game? I imagine that Russia would not want another Chechnya on its border in terms of having a constant guerrilla war. So I can't see any purpose to a total military humiliation of the Georgians. But in war, as you well know, things get out of control.
They do. And wars rarely end the way they were initially conceived. That holds true for Saakashvili, clearly. But that may hold true also for others. I believe that the Russian military objective is to secure South Ossetia. I think to establish full control over that province, and in particular the Ossetian populated part of South Ossetia. There's some regions that are Georgian populated. Some of them are enclaves within Ossetian territory, but others lie on the fringes. So I think that the objective is to securely control that territory, to beef up Abkhazia, and to help the Abkhaz to thwart the Georgian forces from areas within the former boundaries of the Republic of Abkhazia within Georgia that have been occupied by the Georgian forces, the so-called Kadori Gorge. So to consolidate Abkhaz control over Abkhazia and, say, Russian Ossetian control over South Ossetia, to make Georgia sign a formal agreement forswearing the use of force, something that the Russians have been calling on Tbilisi to do for a long time, and Tbilisi flatly refused, because we discussed that at the very beginning, that did not agree with the central policy line of President Saakashvili. The Russians do not regard Saakashvili as a partner anymore. I mean, the same treatment that the United States and its NATO partners accorded to President Milosevic after 1999, after the conflict. The Russians are not going to topple him, but the Russians, I think, will be laying down conditions for the Georgians to reconsider their political choice. Again, I may be a little bit too enamored of this Kosovo / Serbia model of 1999-2000, but I think that the Russians will be going in that direction. And it's it's also difficult for me to dispute the statement that Prime Minister Putin made when he said that the territorial integrity of Georgia has been mortally wounded. I certainly do not see, after what has happened, I certainly do not see South Ossetia returning to Georgia under any format. And I've long held the view that Abkhazia is off limits for a future Georgian state anyway. So basically one will have to, at some point, redraw the borders in the Caucasus the way one has redrawn borders in the Balkans. I believe that there's a certain level of violence, and it doesn't matter whether it's in the Caucasus or in the Balkans, after which cohabitation for ethnic groups becomes impossible. I never believed that Kosovars would be able to live under Serbian rule. I do not believe that the Serbs today in the Mitrovica enclave, Serbian-populated enclave in the north of Kosovo, will actually live under effective Kosovar rule. And unfortunately, I have to agree that South Ossetia has been lost for Georgia. So has been Abkhazia.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time here, Colonel Trenner, that we're left to speculate why the Georgian leader thought or appeared to think that the West would somehow come to his aid or in this dispute after his April 21st conversation with Putin, where the Russian president more or less told him where he could stick the West's support in a rather scatological way. So there's obviously some real bitterness there, and it's not going to go away.
Hatred is the right word. Hatred, right, on both sides, Saakashvili and Putin. But the whole thing is more than that. And I think that from the Russian perspective, the message that Putin was sending to Saakashvili when he was president was something like this: you can have your country whole and neutral in terms of NATO membership, or you can have your country NATO but without the separatist enclaves.
Well, I think it's yours. I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles, Colonel Dmitry Trenin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Masters.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Colonel Dmitry Trenin, who's the Deputy Director of the Moscow Carnegie Center. He served as a colonel in the Soviet and Russian armed forces from 72 to 1993 and was a liaison to the Soviet group forces in Germany, staff member of the delegation of the UN's Soviet Strategic Nuclear Arms Control Talks in Geneva, and he's also was a NATO fellow, and his latest book is Getting Russia Right. I'm now speaking with Dr. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he's also the senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center, an Oxford-trained macroeconomist. He writes frequently for newspapers and magazines, including the New York Times, Washington Post, the LA Times, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, and many others. His most recent book is the award-winning intellectual biography of the late economist John Kenneth Galbraith, entitled John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, and His Economics. Of course, last week on this program, we had John Kenneth Galbraith's son on, and Dr. Parker is the co-founder of Mother Jones, former managing editor of Ramparts, and currently serves on the editorial board of The Nation. He's also been a political advisor to presidential candidates George McGovern, Senator Edward Kennedy, and Congressman Ron Dellums and Edward Markey, among others. He's working on a new book, Nixon's Ghost, How Richard Nixon Created the World We Live In Today and What We Must Do About It. And just last week, he was on an economist roundtable that the New York Times hosted. And let's start with that, Dr. Richard Parker. I read the accounts of that roundtable. There was the Cato people, the libertarians. There were some economists from the left and some from the conservative think tanks. Did you come away with any sense of a consensus that how bleak things are?
No, I don't. I didn't come away with a consensus. I mean, in the area of macroeconomics like that of religion and politics, consensus is always elusive. I think that the important thing for your listeners is to understand that in ideological terms, though, the interesting thing is that Keynes has basically triumphed in a way that no one has noticed and Friedman has lost. By that I mean whether you're conservative or liberal, it is now a given that the federal government has a substantive role in managing the macro performance of the U.S. economy, and that the monetary system controlled by the Federal Reserve should not, as Friedman wanted it, abide by a monetary expansion rule that was essentially stable and very slow growing. What we've seen is Ben Bernanke and his predecessor Alan Greenspan jumping in and actively managing the economy through the monetary supply. In fact, Ken Galbraith, before he died, tweaked his old nemesis Milton Friedman by saying that Alan Greenspan was a monetary Keynesian, which of course Friedman absolutely hated.
Well, is this to say, though, that given that as you were quoted in the New York Times, the government is larger now and acts as an anchor, does this mean, therefore, that talk of another depression is overblown, that the government now is so much bigger than it was back in 1929?
Well, I think there are two structural things to think about and then two dynamic things going forward. The structural thing is that of the size of government. What you have to realize is that in the OECD countries, basically the advanced industrial economies of the West plus Japan, South Korea, the average size of government is as a share of GDP actually, is over 40%. America and Japan are on the way small side, and they're in the mid-low 30%. So in the U.S., basically a third of the U.S. economy is accounted for by the public sector, and on average, it's over 40, going closer to 45%. So to talk about all of these modern 21st century economies as market economies is a little bit like talking about a marriage through the eyes of a husband only. The modern industrial, post-industrial economies of the West are all economies in which government has become a vastly important factor in terms of macro management, regulation, and very targeted kinds of performance enhancements. So what we've lived through in the last 30 years is a kind of ideological attempt to pretend that that wasn't true. But, of course, it is true. Under Ronald Reagan, the share of GDP that went to the federal government was much larger than it ever was under Lyndon Johnson or JFK, or, in fact, even larger by a factor of two than it was under Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. So Reagan presided over an expansion of the federal government that was twice the size of Roosevelt's trying to fight the Depression. And we've had, with George Bush, yet another expansion with an activist, nominal conservative talking small government while practicing big government. Now, having said that, it's very important to distinguish between a simple state-by-state macro situation that I've described and a global problem which is emerging. And the global problem is fairly simple to describe, which is we're consuming now at a rate which the Earth cannot sustain. That is, the inputs are being consumed on a global basis at an ever-accelerating speed. And secondly, the detritus, the waste, the toxic byproducts of human civilization are coming out of these systems at an ever-increasing rate as well, too. China, for example, as you know, became the largest CO2 emitter ahead of the United States just last year. It's a race that the Chinese and the Americans seem bound to win and doesn't seem to be part of the Olympics discussion.
So are you saying that then that the basic ethos of capitalism, which is growth, is incompatible with the biosphere, with the planet?
That would seem to be the case, yeah.
And just to return, that's a big thought, but let's just go yeah. back to what you were just saying there about the growth of government under Reagan and under George W. Bush. it's grown of clearly, but to my mind, and I had this discussion last week with Jamie Galbraith. It's a sort of form of right wing welfare, isn't it?
Where of course, I mean, you can have a right wing Keynesianism and a left wing Keynesianism. I mean, in the 1950s, we had right wing Keynesianism in the form of military Keynesianism. I mean, the 1950s saw enormous growth and enormous increases in well being for a broad swath of Americans, upper class, middle class, lower class. But it was driven in no small part by the fact that half of the federal government's budget was going to the Defense Department. So you can have a conservative Keynesian strategy as well as a progressive Keynesian strategy, and we really ought to stop talking about whether or not we have a choice between Keynesian active intervention or libertarian Friedmanite non-intervention. That's just nonsense. That's like debating whether in the 21st century we're going to turn back to the 20th or the 19th century. We're going forward in the 21st, and Friedman is irrelevant except in a religious sense to the far right.
But I'm surprised that the political left hasn't been able to articulate this in terms of the red states are all, you know, we're talking about, you know, all these red-blooded, patriotic free marketeers are, in fact, on the dole. It's socialism, whether it's agribusiness or defense. And one of them, I mean, and under Bush, they had this extraordinary transfer of public monies to private coffers. Look at the Department of, look at how student loans are now allocated.
Oh, sure, of course.
I mean, it's the analogy is that that we take away money from the post office and subsidize Federal Express.
Right. I don't know what to say in reply. The American left is a broken and fractured thing, and has been for a long time. It became in the 1960s preoccupied with issues of rights rather than economic distribution, and as a consequence has been wrestling through a series of rights issues which are very important. I don't want to demean them in any way, but that have taken them away from fundamental economic distribution issues, which was the bread and butter of a pre-Second World War left going all the way back into the 19th and even 18th century.
Well, another way to put it is they've sort of gotten lost in identity politics.
That's certainly a good way to put it.
So let's go back to the meeting that you had at the New York Times with a group of economists, you among them. It seems to me that from what I read in the New York Times about this, that Alan Greenspan got pretty well slammed as being not entirely responsible for, but his unwillingness to clamp down on either the technology stock bubble or the run-up in the housing prices. How much is he? I mean, is he really that culpable?
Yeah. Yeah, he's entirely culpable, and he's culpable not once but twice. He let this happen in the last several years before he left office in housing prices, and he did it before in the 1990s in terms of the technology stock bubble that we got that crashed immediately under Bush. I mean, there's a complex politics and economics here, which is that the Clintons' narrative of the success of Clintonomics is built in no small part on the expansion of the economy that went on in Clinton's second term, and that was in turn fed in no small part by the rapid rise of the stock market. But that rapid rise, for any economist or business analyst, Wall Street analyst looking at it, was bound to collapse, which it did. It happened to collapse on Bush's watch, and so Bush got some of the liability politically from it. But, you know, had Gore been in office, it would have collapsed on Gore's watch. It was not a stable expansion. And that goes to a much more fundamental problem with the way that American capitalism is adapting to the global challenges that it faces. American capitalism was quite happy before the Second World War to remain largely a domestic capitalism because the size of the markets and the size of opportunities were enormous, and it expanded in domestic markets overwhelmingly with little regard except for natural resource acquisition toward the Third World. After the Second World War, it went through a 25-year period in which American capitalism expanded overseas as the multinational corporation emerged. But again, what you had were really two simple forms of it. One was natural resource extraction, which was the oil companies or other sort of metal or primary commodity companies that operated overseas. And the second was the expansion of a multinational American consumer goods industry that went really basically to Europe and expanded into Europe with acquisition or construction of companies to serve the other great high-wage, high-income, high-consumption area of the world. It wasn't until the 1970s, the coming of the Nixon administration, that you got to a new phase where multinational capitalism looked at the world around it, realized that the tripartite arrangement between big government, big capital, and big labor that had dominated since World War II was no longer holding. And Nixon helped dynamite that with a remnant of that tripartite relationship and inaugurated the new and quite ruthless era of robber baron capitalism, in which the new strategy of multinational American capitalism has been lower manufacturing costs, lower wage costs, get to the lowest production cost platform in order then to export back to high-wage countries, no longer try to go into new high-wage markets with high-wage production, high-wage-based production. And, you know, that's what we've got today. And there's no good politics on the Democratic Party, or certainly not the Republican Party, to deal with it.
And a whole town in Massachusetts can be wiped off the map, if metaphorically speaking, and it, all those jobs go to Sri Lanka overnight.
Yeah.
And there's no moral or patriotic sanction, and the person who makes the money out of that transaction can live tax-free in Bermuda.
Sure.
So that's the part of it that I find extraordinary. And
what's extraordinary about it?
Well, how can these people on the right keep confiscating the flag and the Bible and all the patriotic values when they clearly don't give a damn?
Again, we have lived so long in a conservative-dominated era that we have to state that as a question rather than a declarative
right.
prelude to some
right.
sort of claim to action. I mean,
well, let's.
So go ahead and state it in the interrogative.
I'll stop my little rant here. But the other adjunct to what you're saying is that in effect, you can't dissociate what you're talking about economically in what Nixon created and what has mutated since then into the foreign policy arena, because clearly we are at a stage now where, you know, the empire may bankrupt the republic. I mean, if ever there was an example of a war being fought in the corporate interest and not in the national interest, I don't think you could get a more blatant example than Iraq.
Right. And again, I mean, you're just pointing to sort of a historical chestnut, which is that empires bankrupt economies. They're right. very expensive propositions. They're extractive and seem beneficial initially, but the maldistribution of their benefits and then their rising cost of maintenance always overwhelm them, and they collapse. And, you know, we're in the process of that collapse right now. And, I mean, what, you know, I'm 61, and what my children have to look forward to is a very difficult period. They're not going to earn the same kind of income in terms of purchasing power that my generation or my father's generation did. They're going to be faced with real challenges in terms of overall consumption levels, because the clarity of the stress on the global environment is going to become much clearer. They're not going to have the security of the guaranteed pensions that my father's generation have and that increasingly my generation doesn't have. You know, if a town in Massachusetts like Lowell or Lawrence or New Bedford could once upon a time be wiped out by manufacturing moving overseas, I don't think Cambridge has faced up to the fact that we as an intellectual center are on the cusp of being wiped out, because distance learning and the growth of academic centers in Asia and other parts of the world are going to mean that the value added from people like me situated in 02138 or people sitting at Berkeley or Stanford or UCLA or the like are going to be as undercut in terms of wage value as service workers in the United States are undercut by the wage costs of telephone call centers in India.
Well, just in the last minute, if I could ask you then, since we're all being downsized, can you imagine a new economy that is self-sustaining and hopeful?
Can I imagine? Of course I can imagine it. I mean, it's not a question of economic imagining. It's a question of political will and political determination. I mean, you know, it's very interesting. I started in politics in the sense of being actively involved in politics with John F. Kennedy's 1960 campaign. I was a kid in Southern California. And after my high school class got out, I would bicycle over to the small town JFK for President office and take over from the local Quaker guy who would run it up until 3, and I would run it till 5:45 when I bicycled home and had supper. We've got a new generation of kids who are much less political than that generation that I grew up in, and they're much more fragile, and they aren't visionary in a real sense, or they're sweetly visionary, so that when some of my students came back after Obama lost the New Hampshire primary and they were Obama supporters, they were distressed and distraught and couldn't imagine what was going to happen. They thought Obama was clearly finished, which of course he wasn't. And what I tried to say to them is what I would say to you, which is, you know, what Kennedy did was not so much an achievement of his administration in office, but the release of energies of millions of young men and women like me of a generation just behind him. And if Obama is successful at all, we're not going to measure it by the legislation that he's able to pass or the speeches that he is able to give, but whether or not he can spark in a generation of young people the kind of energy and determination that will actually make this move toward a self-sustaining economy, not just for the United States, but globally, possible. It's the challenge of the 21st century, and I don't think it's one that economists can model predictively with any reasonable confidence. They can model it with typical arrogance, but not with reasonable confidence, because it's ultimately a political, not an economic question.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Dr.
Nice
Richard Parker. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he's also a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. I'm now speaking with Dr. Suzanne Shirk, who is a director of the University of California's System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and a professor of political science at UC San Diego. Susan Shirk has traveled to China in 1971 and has been doing research there ever since. From 1997 to 2000, she served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, with responsibility for China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. And she founded in 1993 and continues to lead the Northeastern Asia Cooperation Dialogue, an unofficial two-track forum for discussions on security issues among defense and foreign ministry officials and academics from the United States, Japan, China, Russia, and the Koreas. And she also serves as a member of the U.S. Defense Policy Board, the Board of Governors of the East-West Center in Hawaii, and the Board of Trustees of the U.S.-Japan Foundation, and the Board of Directors of the National Committee on the United States-China Relations. Her latest book is China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. Just out in paperback with an Olympic-focused introduction. And, of course, Dr. Shirk, I'm sure you, along with the record-breaking numbers of people, watched the extraordinary opening. The story behind the artist responsible for that spectacle is so interesting. The film director who...
Zhang Yimou.
Yes, who was considered... a counter-revolutionary during the Red Guard period, and went through re-education in the rural gulag, if you will, and then became a film director, and then of course he then overreached his relationship with the censors, and they banned him for 5 years. And now, of course, after all that he's been through, many people are accusing him of becoming a kind of pet of the establishment. So I guess you can't win in China, right?
Well, his biography is replicated many-fold, because there are many people who were intellectuals and critics of the government who now have become successfully co-opted, I guess it's fair to say, by all the benefits that the government has to bestow on people. But also, I think that they're quite sincere in their enthusiasm for what has been achieved over the last 25 years in China. So a lot of this patriotic feeling is quite genuine, and they may still have their own criticisms of different aspects, but they want to be part of this amazing thing that has happened in China over the last 25 years. And I think the opening ceremony itself really reflects a growth in what you might call Chinese soft power, because the themes were Chinese history and culture combined with cutting-edge, state-of-the-art technology. And you put those two things together, if you just manage to skip over a lot of the darker side of being a communist state and what's happened in China in the last, you know, in the 20th century, it's really quite a compelling story that, of course, we in the West have been fascinated by Chinese culture and history for centuries. And so once again, China becomes the focus of that positive attention.
Well, I think a very gentle reminder of the enormous power and depth of their history and culture.
Well, yes, of course that's true. And scale is always something that overwhelms people about China. And, you know, it's quite interesting. On the Chinese internet now, there have been Chinese critics of the opening ceremony who argue that basically it's all about how many people China has and the ability of the state to mobilize tremendous financial resources. They're complaining about how much it cost, and that the individual has been lost in that. But of course, I think other people come back and say, well, look, for this kind of event, that's exactly what you want, is to mobilize, you know, large numbers of people in all these fabulous patterns and lights. And obviously, it made for very compelling television, which is how most people saw it.
Well, I understand that the Chinese audience are deeply proud of what they saw and what is happening, but I noticed in a part of the spectacle was the young children dressed in the various ethnic costumes that make up China, and that gets to your book, Dr. Shirk, China, Fragile Superpower: How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. Mm-hmm. The extent to which there are these different ethnic groups within China, but the impression you always get is that the Han Chinese ultimately want to impose their will on all of the those within its borders. And you've had obviously the uprisings in Tibet and the a number of bombs have gone off in the Uyghur territory. Out in the Far East. So, what was that signal there that was embedded in that opening with all those children dressed?
Well, in the People's Republic of China, they have always celebrated all the cultures of the national minorities, and you're right that Han Chinese are the vast majority, and ethnic minorities consist only of under 10% of the population. But they are concentrated in these areas in the far west, in Tibet and Xinjiang, and also Mongolia. So they always emphasize the picture of everybody united around the Communist Party without any ethnic conflict. And what we've seen in the last 6 months or so with the violent protests in Tibet, what happened there, of course, was that what began as a peaceful protest on the part of the Tibetans turned into really a violent ethnic riot on the part of the Tibetans attacking Chinese shopkeepers in Lhasa. And the Chinese public was outraged, and they really stood behind their government very strongly in attacking the Dalai Lama and attacking the Tibetans. So it stimulated a kind of Han nationalist sentiment against the Tibetans because most Chinese thought these folks must be so ungrateful because they know that there are special welfare benefits, health care, education are free, pensions are better, the wages are better, all sorts of special treatment for Tibet. Of course, many of the people who enjoy those privileges are Han, people like those Han shopkeepers who've gone to make money in Tibet. But many of them are also Tibetans, but the benefits didn't trickle down to the ordinary Tibetan very much. But so most Han Chinese are now angry at the Tibetans also for trying to spoil the Olympic celebration. Now, in the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, that's really a very different story. Actually, the separatist feelings in Xinjiang are very strong. They're very hostile to Han rule. And you do have a real terrorist group there. Of course, it's very small, not very capable, linked up with Al-Qaeda. But they have recently been bombing buses and doing other things, which, of course, again, the rank and file, the mass of the Han population now is quite united behind their government against the Uyghurs.
Well, it was the sense of the unification of, and the resurgence of Chinese nationalism was quite even evident here amongst overseas Chinese students studying here in the United States. I'm sure on your campus you perhaps noticed it as well. And it makes you wonder, at least not wonder, but recognize, I think, how the Communist Party of China managed to transition that energy and towards democracy that manifested itself at Tiananmen into a kind of nationalism. They seem to have dodged that bullet, have they not?
Yes, I think it was. That's exactly the way they thought about it during the 1990s when President Jiang Zemin was the leader of China, and they initiated a patriotic education campaign through the schools and the media, which was focused on anti-Japanese nationalism. And certainly that campaign has been all too successful. But I think it was important for us to see the patriotism of overseas Chinese, people who have not been indoctrinated in the Chinese schools, people who may have lived in the United States and other countries for many years. And they're also very excited by this dramatic revival of China as a major power after 150 years, as they talk about this humiliation period, century of humiliation, when China was weak and divided. So
and conquered and ravaged.
Exactly. So, you know, so, and also let's remember that we're patriotic and we always talk about their nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
But these feelings of nationalism or patriotism, whatever you want to call them, are both spontaneous and inculcated by the state.
And as you remind us in your book, China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise, at the end of the day, the men in the Forbidden City, the Politburo, are more concerned about internal matters. They don't see China as this great and threatening superpower. They see themselves as riding a tiger.
That's right. And they've used the patriotic education campaign to try to stimulate popular support for the Communist Party. And I think what you see in the Olympics, and it's some of this is just the accident of having the Tibet protests, then the earthquake, and then the Olympics. The net result of that is a tremendous surge of popular support for the government in China. And if you look at the Pew surveys that came out recently, over 85% of the Chinese public surveyed believe that their government is leading China in the right direction. That's the highest percentage of any country in the world.
Certainly in contrast to ours. And I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Dr. Susan Shirk.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Susan Shirk, is director of the University of California System-Wide Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She's a professor of political science at UC San Diego. And from 1997 to 2000, she served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs with responsibility for China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. And she's the author of a new book, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise, now out in paperback. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Duan, the assistant producer, Nadia Richardson, the engineer.